Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you for your kind emails and DMs regarding the episode with retired Buffalo cop Tom Sino. I wasn't sure how y'all would take that one, because it kind of just seemed like a totally different thing than we normally do, but I was really, really touched when I saw how much it meant to you guys. So that felt really good to hear. And I was just so fascinated and invested in learning more about that side of law enforcement and true crime. So thank you for making me feel good about it and making Tommy feel good about it. I love you. And now let's get ready for a weird case. You're going to need to keep an open mind for this episode, because this does sound very conspiracy theory adjacent. And listen, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I do believe that the man that has presented the information I'm about ready to give to you does seem completely sane, completely respectable, empathetic, interested, and frankly, I'm leaning towards probably right. But here's the thing. This man will never say what he thinks happened to the thousands of people that go missing in national parks. And when I say missing, it's really just vanished in the strangest of circumstances. There are stories where a group of hikers look back after seeing a person they were just with 30 seconds ago in their group, and then they look back again and that person is gone, almost just plucked from the trail. But David Politis, who we will hear his backstory in a minute, doesn't give his exact theories for what's happening here. He leaves it up to you to decide. But he does present some compelling cases that lead me to believe, is there something else out there? And has left me to think, should I stop walking on my ranch at night like a moron? You'll understand once you hear these stories. Before we go into some examples of these missing cases, I have to tell you, as I'm walking around listening to these stories in similar terrain and settings as these cases, they really hit home, and the danger becomes ever more present. Being out in the middle of nowhere, you're bound to see a host of predatory animals. Our friend who lives up the ridge from us is consistently encountering black bears, and even last night, had to fire warning shots to run one off. Our other neighbor and friend caught the biggest mountain lion I've ever seen on his trail cam recently. And with a headlamp on, scanning the land, I've seen animal eyes and figures that are certainly not just deer or antelope. So the danger of animal predators are there. But as you'll hear, there's not much evidence that an attack of that nature has taken place. No human or animal blood has been found around these missing 411 cases. These extremely mysterious circumstances are what David Politis has dedicated himself to understanding and exposing and helping families have some sort of closure. So when a disappearance can't just be summed up as an accident of the elements, a predatory animal, or foul play from a person nearby, what is happening when a child is plucked from the earth in the blink of a parent's eye? They look back and their toddler is suddenly gone within seconds of the last time they set eyes on them. Experienced hunters who know the woods, know the animals they may come in contact with, who are prepared for the elements, just vanish. So, could there be a more paranormal explanation for these very underground and underreported disappearances? Like I said, I encourage you to keep an open mind. I don't know where I stand on this, except that something is out there that we don't quite understand. And the U.S. government hasn't been so discreet in their mutual interest and then cover-up of the cases. They will shut down Freedom of Information Act requests, and then when they do finally release them, large paragraphs are redacted or blacked out. But then again, high-level special forces show up to routine missing person searches only to tell other volunteers that this area is unsearchable. Many of these men are Green Berets in certain circumstances. One would think they could handle some questionable terrain, danger, anything. Isn't that what they got to their level of training to do? This is Seven Deadly Sinners Missing 411. Pride. Secrets unknown and held tightly by federal offices.
My recommendation to anybody, if you ever have an encounter in the woods, is don't fool with them, don't make eye contact, don't point, and surely don't point a gun. Do not engage this creature, because if you do, you will lose.
According to the Department of Justice's National Missing and Unidentified Person System, NAMIS, 600,000 people in the United States go missing every year. Although the majority of these cases resolve successfully, the database shows that tens of thousands of missing persons cases grow cold. Of these cold cases, former police officer and author of the Missing 411 series of books, David Politis, believes that around 1,600 went missing on national public lands, many of which have allegedly gone unreported. So, what happened to them? Well, we may never know, but at least David Politis is trying. So who is David Politis? David Politis is an American cryptozoologist, which means cryptozoology is like a pseudoscience and subculture that searches for and studies unknown, legendary, or extinct animals whose present existence is disputed or unsubstantiated. Think the Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, Jersey Devil, Chupacabra. You get the point. Before retiring from the police force, he was a member of the Fremont Police Department and then the San Jose Police Department, and eventually was a member of their SWAT team. He then earned detective status and served as part of the Vice Intelligence Unit. After his retirement, he began his interest in the unknown, beginning with researching and hunting Bigfoot, becoming somewhat of an expert in this field, as he was approached by two park rangers who had heard of him, and they told him of strange disappearances in national parks that really disturbed them. This was then the beginning of his career in exposing missing 411 cases. And whatever you believe, it does seem that exposure is needed in these cases. Here's a clip from one of David Politis' Missing 411 documentaries, where he's interviewing a former FBI agent.
When an investigation starts to push the limits of standard everyday police protocol, I start to look for professionals on the outside that could assist me. I'm someone who's not so stubborn as to admit what I don't know. And at this point, I looked for professional help in the name of retired FBI agent John D'Souza.
My name is John D'Souza. I was an FBI special agent for 25 years. I've worked all types of cases, counterterrorism, violent crimes, paranormal cases as well. And I'm pretty well known for that sort of thing.
Now, your background to me is interesting because you've worked a variety of criminal cases.
I worked the Unabomber case. I worked 1994 World Trade Center bombing.
The biggest case you ever worked?
It would have to be 9/11.
John, how many times have you testified in front of a U.S. court for a U.S. attorney?
Maybe like 100 times.
And how many times has the court decided that you're an expert in a certain area?
Probably every time I've testified.
I can't think of anybody who's in a position more to tell the truth and with great things to risk than you. And the agent said, Dave, our government will never acknowledge what they can't control. And I always remembered that statement. You believe that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. They can't acknowledge it if they can't control it, or even if they think they can't control it.
Examples of this include not keeping records of the missing people vanished from their national parks, SWAT teams that wouldn't normally be at the search for a missing person, and evasive FOIA retrievals or outright refusal to disclose them. Which is what happened in this missing 411 case of a young girl named Stacy Aris. Stacy Ann Aris was 14, and along with her father, George Aris, and six other family members, they embarked on a week-long mule trip through the backcountry at Yosemite National Park. The group was riding along the High Sierra Loop Trail at the Tuolumne Meadows, and according to the National Park Service, Tuolumne Meadows is the largest high-elevation meadows in the Sierra Nevada. It stands at 8,600 feet. Stacy, along with her father and family friends, reached the last camp on the loop, which was Sunrise High Sierra Camp. That was on Friday, July 17, 1981. This camp could accommodate close to 40 people, and it was at full capacity that day. So plenty of people around. So once they arrived, they settled in, and Stacy still felt ready to explore. And she asked her dad if he wanted to go for a walk, but he said he wanted to relax after the long trip. And if you think about it, it's fine that he said she could go off on her own. She's 14. She's surrounded by people she knows. This is a familiar place. And Stacy wasn't known to just wander off, nor was there any indication that she was trying to become a runaway. Additionally, she was seen and interacted with a member of the group the family was camping with. And as she's walking towards the trail, she encounters Gerald Stewart, who was a man in his 70s, traveling with them. He was sitting on a boulder near the trailhead, and she asked him if he wanted to go with her. And he figured, all right, trail's not too difficult. Yes, I'm in my 70s, but sure. So Stacy and Gerald headed out a short distance. Gerald told Stacy he needed to sit down after a while, though. So they stopped just above Sunrise Lakes. It wasn't far from the camp at all, though. And one of the tour guides who were with the group saw Gerald sit down on the boulder as he had gotten tired, like I said, and Stacy decided to walk toward the lake. Sadly, Gerald and the tour guide would be the last people to ever see Stacy alive again. Stacy walked down a granite hillside towards a tree line that surrounded the lake. It's under a mile as the crow flies from camp to Sunrise Lake, so not far at all, but when she didn't return within the next hour, her group and her father started to worry, and they began a search. Still not frantic, but concerned, others in the camp helped in the search. They made several passes along the trail, searching, and they spoke to other hikers who claimed they never saw her. It was as if she had evaporated into thin air. And now it was serious. Searchers began calling out for her, combing all areas around the trail, off trail. And the only item found connected to Stacy was the lens cap for her camera. After about an hour of searching to no avail, authorities were called in, and then a massive search operation was launched, involving 150 people, including 67 Mountain Rescue Association volunteers, using tracker dogs and helicopters, scouring the vicinity. They found nothing at all. There were no tracks found, none of her belongings. Even the dogs could not pick up a scent. It was almost as if she had never been there at all. All they found was the lens of Stacy's camera. No clothes were found, no flip-flops, which she had just changed into to go on that walk, no camera, blood, nothing. The Park Service called off the search after 12 days, failing to find Stacy. Many things about this case struck David as odd. First of all, it fit his criteria of profile points, the link that connects all of these missing 411 cases. David believes there's an underlying story to all of them, and he will only investigate them if they fit into this criteria. Number one, there's a lack of scent trail. They bring canines in and they cannot pick up any scent trail. They bring trackers in and they can't find tracks, or they seem to disappear. Number two, there are weather-related issues before, during, or after the disappearance. This is a severe weather incident that makes searching even more difficult. Number three, the victim is eventually found in an area that was previously searched, and not just once, but 7 or 8 times thoroughly, to the point that it doesn't even make sense, if they are even found at all. And number four, the location that the person goes missing in is an area near boulder fields, water, swamps, or granite. They are also often found berry picking before they go missing. And what scares me perhaps the most is the odd number of search and rescue planes that have crashed while searching for these people. It's just so unnervingly odd. But beyond these patterns and odd occurrences is the red tape that the National Park Service and various government entities put up. David Politis believes the biggest obstacle to getting any information about missing people in the wild is the National Park Service. He speculates that the Park Service conceals the true data on how and where people disappear, and how many have actually been found because, quote, it would shock the public so badly that visitor numbers would fall off a cliff, end quote. And he has experienced this lack of information and transparency firsthand. This case disturbed David Politis as much as it does to us hearing it years later. And David felt compelled to look into it more. So then he filed a FOIA request. And the response he gets will lead us into the sin of this episode. Pride. Institutional level pride, shrouded also in secrecy. Secrecy more easily accessible because the national parks operate almost like sovereign states. After 30 years and no leads on Stacy's case, David filed the FOIA request. A legal right as a public citizen to obtain information on many things, but in this case, specifically a missing persons case. David makes a request to Yosemite National Park to get a copy of the report. And he says, quote,
a special agent for the Park Service named you called me and asked me why I wanted the report. And I explained that we were doing some research on the search and rescue, and we were specifically looking into people who had disappeared at Yosemite, and we wanted to see what there was in the report, and he said there was nothing there. And I said, well, are there any suspects? Is it a criminal case? And he said, nope, it's a missing persons case. I said, has anyone looked at it in the past 10 or 20 years? He says, not that I can think of. And I said, so there's no suspects, and there's no work done on the case. She hasn't been found. He says, correct. And I said, okay, well, could you send me a copy of the case? And he said, nope. After the special agent for National Park Service says nope again, I say, why not? He says, because it's an open case and you'll never see it. I reply, but we've got dozens and dozens of missing person cases from the Park Service. Why not this case? He goes, you'll never see it. And I said, what do you mean I'm not going to get it? It's an open missing persons case. Are there any criminal elements? Nope, he replies. I said, are there any suspects? Nope. Well, why won't you give it to me then? And then he says, well, we never give away these cases. And I said, wait a minute. I have dozens and dozens of these cases from your agency all over the U.S. He says, no, you don't. I say, yes, I do. And we get into this talk, and he challenges me, and he's rude. He says, right from the get-go, I'm never going to get this. And so far, he's right.
Stacy, among many others, have never been found. There are stories of experienced hunters who are never seen again. Ones that make no sense at all. Children that vanish in the blink of an eye are then found. Or evidence of their clothing miles away up a mountaintop with no evidence of an animal attack and on terrain that experienced hikers and outdoorsmen can barely summit. Yet a 3-year-old somehow makes it up there. Now we're going to dive into the theories, the internet, and several missing 411 documentaries and books have alluded to. So here are the theories the internet and really my brain also suspect. But let me just say, I don't know. This is a modern mystery. I could be completely inaccurate. I'm just telling you how I feel. In my theory, for many of these cases, certainly not all, because I think foul play could have been involved in a few, but my main go-to is the possibility of the off-the-grid humans or feral humans. There's some recent controversy surrounding this term, but I don't mean it mean. Hell, I might be feral at this point myself because I live in the middle of nowhere with far more rare human interaction than most, so maybe these are my people. But I do kind of, I'm leaning towards the feral person, all right? So let's go into three different stories that lead me in the direction of feral people, okay? So a post from Reddit stated this. I live in the Great Smoky Mountains, and I know what snatches children. I'm on the North Carolina side of the Great Smoky Mountains, lived here my entire life. All of us here know what's in these woods and mountains. Since the 30s or 40s, there have been feral wild men living in these mountains, and they are fast. They will snatch livestock and snatch children. The FBI knows. It's why they do not get involved. I've heard other stories that there was some attempt to kill these feral wild men, but they still exist. Even today, I'm not talking about some end of days extremist who took to the woods. I mean, feral, completely wild men, their own language, living underground. We do not go into the woods at night. During the day, we make sure to stay on the trails. Sometimes you will smell it, that putrid smell. At night, you'll hear them hollering. Now, this really resonated with me because, yes, Reddit can be like a treasure trove of information, but also like a bully forum. But I remember hearing the sounds that this guy's describing in something called the Sierra Sounds. I heard it on another podcast, I think, in their intro. I think it's Bigfoot Encounters. It's a great podcast. You should listen. But I only heard snippets of it. So then I Googled the Sierra Sounds, and what I heard was terrifying.
You shouldn't talk to this.
Mm-hmm. across the creek at the big rocks. It's a hard act to follow.
They sound like he talks to us and they talk to each other.
Now, as we keep those Sierra sounds in mind, I'm going to end this episode on the case of Mike Woolley. Mike Woolley seems like kind of a salt-of-the-earth rugged man who likely has no interest in being on camera, having his story recorded anything. Yet he earnestly tells what happened to him. Not for fame, it seems. He just seems like a down-to-earth guy telling his story. And after listening to him, I kind of believe him. So Mike Woolley was an avid hunter, living in Louisiana. And he'd planned his hunt one day, and he situated himself up in his deer stand above ground in the woods off an old logging road. This was an area he knew well. He hunted it often and felt he knew the ins and outs of it. But the funny thing about life, especially in the great outdoors, is you really never know what you're going to encounter. There's swift shifts in weather patterns that you're unprepared for. There's poisonous plants. And well, in Mike's case, a wild creature he had never seen before. So Mike parks halfway down the road from his deer stand. He climbs into his deer stand and waits for the perfect shot. And then suddenly he hears an animal. And a small doe shows up, sweating and stressed. But he assumed it had been chased by a large buck, and he thinks, any time now, a prize-winning buck is going to show up, and that's my chance. But he was wrong, because instead of a buck, a large man, covered in hair, appeared, and he was chasing the doe. And he then noticed Mike's presence and stared at him with menacing, angry eyes. There was something off about this creature, and Mike contemplated this could be a Bigfoot, but somehow it seemed to be more human. And then the whistle calls, like the Sierra sounds, and Mike then ran for his life. But I'm going to let him tell you in his own words to end this episode.
The reason I didn't shoot it is it was just too human. The face, it was a bipedal. You know, it walked two legs, just like we did. But it was just too human. The face was too human. The eyelashes, the teeth, the jaw structure, the forehead, it was light brown. The face was light brown, like it had a dark suntan. But I couldn't pull the trigger because something told me this ain't right. It's not the right thing to do. My name is Mike Woolley. I'm from Kechai, Louisiana. I had an encounter back in December of 1981 with a Bigfoot while deer hunting. It was a beautiful December day. Perfect weather for a hunt. Temperature was about 30 degrees. I got to my deer stand that evening, about 3 o'clock, got on it. And I was sitting there, and I was facing to the north. And my deer stand was located about a mile and a half down an old logging road and off the main highway, secondary highway. And what I would do, I would park my truck halfway down the logging road, and I would walk in the rest of the way because I didn't want to drive my truck down and spook the deer. Well, it must have been, I hadn't been there no more than 30 minutes. And this little young doe deer come running from the east out of some briars and brush that there's no way a human could walk through that. But she come up to my deer stand, and what was so amusing, come up to my deer stand and laid down, up and actually touching the deer stand. She was wringing wet with sweat. She had been run. Something had been running her. And the first thing hit my mind, it was a big buck. And I said, I'm going to kill me a big buck. So when I raised my head back up, I was turning my head, and out of my peripheral vision, I seen something hop to a tree. And it was tall, about 7-8 foot tall, and it was black, real hairy, like a gorilla. And I knew it wasn't a gorilla because there was no circus in town, and I knew it hadn't escaped, and I knew we didn't have no gorillas running loose. So the first thing hit my mind, it was somebody dressed up in a suit trying to scare me off my good deer hunting spot. Well, I immediately go to talking to this thing, telling it, you know, take the head off, get out of here, you know, don't come back, you know, this ain't no joke, I don't find it funny, you know, just leave. Well, this thing was just eyeballing me, you know, looking at me and really giving me some sinister looks. And I knew right then, I said, you know, something ain't right. Well, this went on for a few minutes, and he must have been about 20 yards from me, 15, 20 yards. So I take my rifle. I've got a high-powered rifle with a high-powered scope on the rifle. And I look through the scope at the creature. And I knew that after looking at it, I was in a situation because it was cold. You know, the moisture was coming out of its mouth, its nostrils. It looked really, really human. The face was human. The eyelashes, I could see the eyelashes, you know, the eyes, the teeth were big teeth, flat teeth like our teeth. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it, and it just, it's really PO'd at me. And it lets out a roar like a lion. Well, about 100 yards to the northeast, there's this really, really loud whistle comes back, you know, a signal to the growl. Well, this creature looks over that way and whistles back in the same tone of whistle and then turns and looks at me. Well, I'm kind of like, hey, you know, what's going on here, you know? Something's up. I'm in trouble, big trouble. Well, all of a sudden I hear movement coming from that direction, and I knew whatever he signaled was coming to meet up with him. And I knew that I was probably going to be the one going to be on the losing end of the stick, you know. Well, I thought it was a feral human because I'd heard about them, you know, done some reading about them. But so far as a Bigfoot, I thought that was something that existed out in California. I just thought that was something somebody made up to make money off of. Well, I jumped down off my stand, and I'm running to the west to get to my truck. And I look over my left shoulder, and this creature is running through the woods, and it is just moving brush. It's running through the brush, and it's bulldozing the brush down. And I knew, man, this thing is going to get me. It is mad. It is PO'd. It's going to get me. Well, I'm coming up on my truck, and I'm thinking, well, I got to stop to unlock my truck. And when I get ready to unlock the truck, he's going to make his move. He's going to have me. Well, something crossed my mind to fire a warning shot. Well, when I got to the tailgate of the truck, I threw my rifle to the left, pulled the trigger, and the shot fired, and the bullet hit about 7 foot up in a tree and blew bark in front of his face. The bark actually hit him in the face because he was about 3 foot from the tree. If the creature would have been another 2 seconds, the bullet would have hit him dead in the head. Well, I got in a truck, I'm driving off, I look in my rearview mirror, and lo and behold, his buddy that he had signaled had been tailing me coming up the logging road. I didn't have but one chasing me, I had two. Well, they kind of stood there and looked at each other as I was driving off.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I only covered maybe 1% of these cases. It would be a very long episode or a series of them if I went into it further. but I'm kind of into this. And if you guys are, please DM me at 7 Deadly Sinners Podcast on Instagram or at 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. And just let me know if you're kind of into it, because I kind of want to cover the other ones and there's some UFO connections. But just let me know. Again, thank you guys so much for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating, positive review, wherever you listen to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and I love you. Thank you.